The heat wave in much of America is almost over, but the next wave is the electricity bills. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, July 4th. Thanks for being with us on this American Independence Day. Now, here in the Bay Area of California, it is cloudy and a little chilly, and I am definitely not complaining because a heat wave, as you know, has been frying parts of the Midwest and Northeast. It's had millions of people blasting their ACs at full power. That is causing record surges in electricity demand in some places, and that will lead to some higher than expected electric bills for businesses and individuals. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from a sweltering Washington, D.C., with more on the economic effects of this heat wave.
I call this insta-sweat weather. You know, where the moment you step outside, you're instantly drenched in sweat. Too much information, I know. Kiran Bhattaraju, CEO of Arcadia Power, says we should get used to the heat and higher energy prices.
It's a problem that's sort of an ugly climate feedback loop. You have these really high spikes in temperature. Customers are experiencing this more often, and utilities have to raise their prices to keep up with it.
He says that's especially true in what are called competitive energy markets, where the price of electricity is tied to demand at a particular time of day.
A customer can really get screwed. They can pay prices, you know, two, three, four times the average price for power.
And if someone is living on a tight budget, that price jump can have a huge effect. Carolyn Ratcliffe of the Urban Institute says many people are already walking a financial tightrope.
A heat wave of even a few days can knock them off balance.
And that's just talking about the higher utility bills.
But there can be bigger ramifications for family budgets. A car overheating or breaking down, that can lead to an expensive car repair bill.
Or lost wages from missing work. Ratcliffe also warns of the health consequences of the hot, humid weather. If the heat sends someone to the doctor or emergency room, it can also saddle them with another bill to pay. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Insult to injury for Kimberly, the AC wasn't even on in the D.C. Bureau today. Now, one way to beat the heat is to go to the movies. Stay for the credits to stay cool and to see where it was filmed. State-sponsored film and TV incentives are a big driver for business. New Jersey's governor signed a bill yesterday that will offer tax credits to production companies that film movies and television shows there. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports there's a battle going on among states to get the entertainment industry to come to town.
Camera operator Matt Harshbarger lived in Austin, Texas for 11 years with his wife and two kids. Then, a few years ago, the state decided to scale back its tax incentive program for film and TV. He says the jobs in Austin dried up, so he had to travel for work.
There was a three-year period where I was in Puerto Rico, I was in Baton Rouge, I was in New Orleans, and had done one show in Austin during that time.
Eventually, Harshbarger and his family loaded up and relocated to New Mexico. Tax incentives, he says, mean a lot to production companies.
In Albuquerque, there were, I think, 8 TV shows going there, and 6 of them, like the story took place in Texas, but they were all being shot in New Mexico because of tax incentives.
Louisiana became the first state to offer incentives for film productions in 1992. States like Georgia, North Carolina, and now New Jersey have beefed up their incentive programs, luring big projects away from states that scaled them back, like Colorado and Texas. California just passed a new set of incentives last year. Nancy Ray Stone is the program director for the California Film and Television Tax Credit Program.
If California doesn't offer even its modest incentive, these projects will go elsewhere.
Opponents of the tax breaks say incentives spend dollars to capture pennies, and some states even lose money because of them. The New Jersey Office of Legislative Services says the tax credits could cost the state $425 million in lost revenue over 5 years. But supporters argue there's uncalculated economic benefit from luring the entertainment industry back. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, markets are closed for the July 4th holiday, but don't worry, we wrestled up some numbers for you. The unemployment rate is down, and a tight labor market can open things up for groups that frequently have higher rates of unemployment, like people with disabilities. Their unemployment rate was over 9% in 2017. That's compared to just above 4% for people without a disability, according to the Labor Department. Tyson Pope got his bachelor's in history last year from UC Berkeley. He shared his story about his own job search.
I'm dyslexic, dysgraphic, and have attention deficit disorder. K through 12, I was put in special day classes. Those classes were like 5 to 10 students, and students from all spectrum of developmental disabilities. I was put in those classes throughout middle school and then throughout high school, and I was never really prepared for community college or anything like that. I didn't apply to any universities when I graduate high school. I was just happy to graduate. I started working at Walgreens, and I enrolled in Riverside Community College in Southern California. And I started just taking, you know, one class at a time because I wasn't too sure if college was even for me. I learned how to learn with my disability. I graduated with my associate's degree in 2008 with distinction. But I found out that I couldn't really get a job with an associate's degree. I applied to the UC system, and, you know, I got in. And it was a little bit challenging at first, getting my accommodations. I graduated with honors from Berkeley. So that brings me to now, and I'm currently looking for a job, and it's very hard. It's not very easy for people with disabilities like me to navigate the system. There's no one you can talk to. That's when I'm like running into like roadblocks and frustration with the job search. You think when you graduate a school like Berkeley, fill out, you know, applications, submit your resume, kind of a job would get handled. Right now I'm a substitute teacher for Prince William County School District. Right now it's summer school, so there's no opportunities for me to pick up assignments. I'm currently unemployed. I'm just like waiting. It does ask you, are you an American with a disability? I do check yes, but it doesn't give me an option to explain it, like what kind of disability I have. And it's frustrating, too. It's just because we hear like this current administration, you know, say that the unemployment for African-Americans is at a record low. But, you know, it's I don't know what kind of jobs they're looking at because I'm unemployed or underemployed and I'm African-American male. And that statement isn't really true for me. I know that I'm fortunate enough to have a family that supports me. Both my siblings are attorneys. So, you know, I'm financially, you know, being supported by them. But, you know, I'm 35 years old and it's embarrassing. I'm getting embarrassed, you know, for myself because I'm not employed. But I'm going to keep on fighting. I know it's like the story of my life. Things take a little bit longer for me. And this is just another situation where it's just going to take a little bit longer, but I know eventually someone will come across my resume and they'll believe in me as much as I believe in myself.
We did a full hour-long special on the economics of disability. You can hear more at marketplace.org. We're just 4 days into July, obviously, and a little more than 2 weeks into summer, but we are months into the summer music festival season. South by Southwest in Austin, Coachella in the Southern California desert, Pitchfork and Lollapalooza in Chicago, and of course, hundreds of smaller one-day or weekend events. And every one of them is an opportunity for stands selling every manner of crafts and band merch and food and drink. The festival circuit is big business for small businesses. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Are you ready to party this Tuesday night? Tens of thousands turned out this spring for the annual Texas Music Festival near the small town of Stephenville. The multi-day tickets cost upwards of $100. The festival, packed with hot and hungry country music fans, was good business for this guy's food truck.
My name's Chip Winkle.
Okay, what's the specialty?
We have the chocolate dip bacon, we have the bacon wrapped sausage.
And what are most people drinking?
Whiskey, beer and whiskey.
The food truck supports five family members working festivals all over the country.
This summer we'll be going up into Minnesota and New York. We did the Mardi Gras.
You make a good living?
It's what we do. It's what we know.
It's hard to say exactly how much music festivals pump into local economies. One study of concert promoter Insomniac found it generated more than $3 billion in spending over 4 years. Portland, Oregon's Waterfront Blues Festival kicks off today. Artistic director Peter Damon says it's a hot ticket.
The food vendors, we have one opening every 5 years, maybe. It's not about whose sandwiches we would like to have served here. It's like who can turn out $30,000 worth of sandwiches. It's volume.
Drew Jacobs runs a Hawaiian food booth here and says he's ready.
We're at 800 pounds of Kahlua pig and producing more, just to be sure.
He says the money's good, and serving for 80,000 festival goers will boost business for his two restaurants in town long after the music ends. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Summer is also berry season in Britain, but this year, finding enough workers to pick those berries is a big problem. The number of seasonal workers from Eastern Europe has dropped 12.5%, and Britain's main farmers union is warning that fruits and vegetables could be left to rot. With Britain also about to leave the European Union, the situation could get even worse, because free movement of workers is no longer guaranteed. The BBC's Claire Marshall traveled to Romania, where many of those workers come from.
We're about 150 miles north of Bucharest, and we've stopped in the little strawberry plantation just by the side of the road. And under the sun in bright T-shirts, I can see a little group of women just down the end, backs bent, picking the strawberries. Far fewer seasonal workers from Eastern Europe now want to travel to Britain to pick the fruit on our farms. The reasons are complex. She says her friends prefer to go to Germany and Spain. This lady says the job opportunities are getting better in Romania.
It's crazy how difficult it's getting, isn't it?
Well, recruitment agents Estera and Doug Amers are trying to track down pickers that want to come to the UK.
Things started becoming much, much harder since Brexit for us, for our business, definitely. It's the uncertainty, because no one knows what's happening. You know, is it going to become harder for me to come?
After driving for 2.5 hours, we get close to the border with Moldova. At the end of a dusty track, we reach the little village of Balad. Waiting outside a shop is a group of around 30. So these could be exactly the kind of workers that UK farmers need. The problem is now, they take a lot more persuading. The drop in the pound after the Brexit vote was crucial. These people would now earn less for the same work. Only five sign up. The latest figures from the Association of Labour Providers show that already this year more than half the companies sourcing labour for UK farms can't find enough workers. Romania is one of the poorest countries in Europe. However, almost 30 years after the revolution and the fall of communism, its economy is growing at almost three times the rate of the UK's, creating a newly wealthy middle class. Many young people here tell us they have no intention of picking fruit. Piu is a geography student.
English people could pick their own fruit, not let it rot. That's why I find Brexit really strange, because the foreigners come to do the low-paid jobs.
We need an incentive.
Estera and Doug now have to recruit workers that before they would have turned away.
Previously, we were looking for people with some English. Right now, we find it difficult to recruit anyone with English.
Georgetta doesn't have to worry about finding labour. She grows, picks and sells her own strawberries by the side of the road. But the question now is who's going to supply the British with British summer fruit? In Romania, I'm Claire Marshall for Marketplace.
Thank you.
Coming up...
People are used to having cars on the street, but they're not used to seeing all these new vehicle types around. So there's a bit of a learning curve, but there's a huge opportunity to change how people travel in cities.
Spoiler alert, those new vehicle types, they're bikes. But first, let's do the numbers. Here in the U.S., markets are closed for the Independence Day holiday. In Europe, Britain's FTSE and Germany's DAX both dipped 0.25%. France's CAC 40 rose less than 0.1%. German automakers rose on reports that several car company CEOs met with U.S. officials today to argue against threatened U.S. import duties on European vehicles. BMW edged up about 0.1%. Volkswagen revved up 0.4%. Daimler drove up 0.5%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually, every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look. Payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. 2018 isn't just America's 242nd birthday year. It is also the 10-year anniversary of the 2008 financial crisis. And all year, we've been examining how the crisis and recession changed America. And we've been asking you, our listeners, how the crisis changed your own life. Today's story comes from Los Angeles.
My name is Scheherazad Sherry Wood. I work at Texolini, and my title here is Director of Merchandising. Well, if you know anything about Middle Eastern culture, they always either want you to be a doctor or a lawyer. But I think my interest in fashion started at a young age, and they could see that as I was growing up. I remember 2008, and that was a really sad time. I had my own business, and I was looking for investors to start my own collection. And the two that I had immediately pulled out because of the crisis, they just were not interested in investing in new businesses. So after my husband's work also and career changed, I basically became the breadwinner of the family. And that's why I had to go back and get a full-time job where I could have more consistency and stability. I think everything happens for a reason. Since that time, you know, I had my daughter. She's 6 now. The priorities shifted. Now I want to have more time with my daughter and be there for her in these early years. Fashion, the way people shop, the way they search for things, everything has changed so much from the time I started. I try to keep myself updated with the younger generation. I'm just trying to learn and keep learning and keep growing. And when the time is right, hopefully an opportunity will present itself that I can pursue.
Tell us how the financial crisis changed your life at marketplace.org/divided decade. On any given afternoon in San Francisco, traffic is at a standstill. But plenty of other wheels are on the move. On the city's Embarcadero Street, which runs along the waterfront, fleets of rented bikes and scooters mingle with the pedestrians. People use an app to rent those bikes or scooters, ride around for a short trip, and lock them up when they get wherever they're going. Ryan Japetsky is the CEO of Jump Bikes. Last month, Uber bought his company, so people with the Uber app can either hail a car or borrow a bicycle with a small electric motor on it. It's part of a wave of investment in two-wheeled transportation that includes scooters and bikes of all types. In fact, on Tuesday, Lyft announced it was buying a company called Motivate, which operates bike rental programs around the country, including Citibike in New York. On the one hand, this so-called micro-mobility trend is great for beating traffic. But cities are also wrestling with bikes and scooters that can clog up sidewalks, endanger pedestrians, and, oh, by the way, collect your data. Here's Jepetsky.
Yeah, I feel like we're at the birth of a new industry, which is really exciting. You see a ton of investment from a lot of different players right now, investing in electric bikes and electric scooters, and really shifting away from large, heavy, expensive automobiles. And there's going to be some growing pains where people are used to having cars on the street, but they're not used to seeing all these new vehicle types around. So there's a bit of a learning curve, but there's a huge opportunity to change how people travel in cities.
How can you help with that learning curve? Because, you know, we see people riding around without helmets or on the sidewalk instead of the street, which I think is where you're supposed to have your bike.
There's definitely some education for the users. The bigger threat to both bicyclists and pedestrians is cars, though. A lot of cities now are working on Vision Zero, which is reducing car crash fatalities with a goal of eventually having zero. Generally, when you shift people to bikes, it's a safer mode for everybody.
Although this is also bike with a with an electric boost.
It is, but the top speed is 20 miles an hour, which is comparable to what you could do if you're really exerting yourself on a regular bike. And I noticed that most novice users just kind of putt along around 10 to 15.
So tell us about the relationship with Uber. You started out in a partnership and now Uber has acquired Jump. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So, I think Uber saw that some of their existing customers were taking the bikes rather than cars for some of these trips. Our average trip length is 2.6 miles, which is actually very similar to trip lengths for Uber in cities. And it made sense to put the two pieces together.
Well, it's interesting because one of the concerns, I guess, about Uber and Lyft is that they've added a lot of cars to the road. Do you think that they saw you as first competition and then complementary?
I think that there is a big opportunity here where one of the primary criticisms is this congestion claim, which I think that the overall society benefit of having rideshare is a net reduction of automobile usage. But that is one of the criticisms. And there is this opportunity to shift people out of those car trips and onto bikes very directly, where if you're in the app, you can see, okay, this is how much it's going to cost and how long it's going to take in a car, and this is what it's going to cost and how long it's going to take on a bike. So I think there's a direct impact there.
And then talk to me about data. I know my understanding is that part of that deal with the city was that you would provide real-time GPS, you know, location information. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, that is a part of Uber's app already, location collection. Yeah. How much data are you collecting?
We really believe in sharing that data with cities to improve bike infrastructure so they can see where bikes are traveling and hopefully build out more bike lanes. You know, we have to be mindful of users' privacy and so that we're sharing the data in a way that's anonymized.
How are you communicating that to users?
In the privacy and data policy.
I mean, is it clear to users, you know, if I open up the app, am I going to see something that says, hey, listen, there's a GPS on this bike. I know this is something you're all worried about right now.
I think there's always been a bit more acceptance because people realize that this is a bike that we're tracking. This is our asset that we're tracking and that they are riding, which is different than tracking something that they own. The fact is that many apps and services or telecom providers have this type of data already. The fact that it's tracking our vehicle, generally more people have been accepting of that.
And then how much do you need to engage in the city or engage with the city in terms of kind of all of the other two-wheel transportation? Like, do you worry that there will be a point where they say, you know what, we're just going to outlaw it because it's too dangerous to pedestrians, fairly or unfairly,
yeah,
you know, and sort of set back your plan?
Yeah, so I think cities overall are trying to be more bike-friendly. On the other hand, folks have seen what happened in China when there was a massive oversupply, when there's piles of bikes on the street. And so there is a need to regulate here. There needs to be some sort of rational regulation. And they actually went through this process with the ride-hail industry. There wasn't really a good set of rules. The main difference being that these vehicles are actually on the streets and on the sidewalks in a way that the ride-hail vehicles aren't. So they're actually taking up public space. So it's almost more urgent for them to figure out the answer to this question. How do you put in rational caps? How do you allow systems to scale when people are using them? And how do you protect the public interest?
Brian Jepetsky is CEO of Jump Bikes. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The This final note before we go, it is getting close to fireworks time today, and whether you are pro or con, the folks over at Vox have put together a lot of charts and numbers to illustrate one simple truth about fireworks. In their words, quote, teenage boys are idiots. The Journal of Surgical Research notes that men and boys accounted for 76% of all fireworks-related hospital admissions between 2006 and 2010, with, you guessed it, a huge spike every July. There were almost 13,000 hospital visits related to fireworks in 2017, according to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. Although, to be fair, the only major fireworks incident I can remember from my youth was my mom lighting her hair on fire with a sparkler. Sorry, Mom. And that's it. We got to go. The markets were closed today for Independence Day, but we were open. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered this program for us. I am Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a wonderful holiday. Kai will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.